numbers of his countrymen with the warmest sentiments towards our people, Churchill says to the members of Parliament. The same Roosevelt, of whom Churchill now speaks so warmly, is the very politician who was just given Berlin to the Russians. All Allied forces on their Western Front, Field Marshal Bernard Law Montgomery's included, been ordered to halt 60 miles short of Berlin on the banks of the Elbe River. The command came from General Dwight Eisenhower, who now inexplicably sees Berlin as having no strategic value. Yet, as Winston Churchill knows all too well, the order could not have been given without the approval of Franklin Roosevelt. There are 4 million Allied soldiers in Germany right now, and 3 million of them are American. The people of the United States would find it unsettling to see a British commander get the glory of capturing the German capital, though Eisenhower sees no problem in allowing a Russian commander to know that very same sense of glory. The British people now will be denied that symbolic moment when Monty and his Tommies march into Berlin. There will be no victorious poses in front of Hitler's bombed-out Reichstag, allowing all of England to rejoice that their plucky island nation persevered in the face of long odds and finally conquered the Führer's capital. Making the betrayal sting even more is the fact that Churchill is half American. His mother, the beautiful Jenny Jerome Randolph, is from Brooklyn. His grandfather was editor of the New York Times. His ancestors came to America on the Mayflower, and a later generation wintered with George Washington at Valley Forge and waged a revolution against the British. Churchill is even distantly related to a Native American of the Iroquois Nation. In this way, his forefathers were even more American than those of the late president. Yet it is America that now commits the unconscionable act of deferring to Russia at the expense of Britain, in effect, killing England. Winston Churchill is sad. Sad for his lost friends, sad for FDR's betrayals, sad for his nation, and in the end, sad for the uncertainty that is to come. Churchill has already exchanged a number of cables with Harry Truman and has yet to get a clear read on him. After so many years of being wary of Nazi Germany, Churchill now sees the Russians as the world's greatest threat. The divide between the communist worldview and that of Britain's is so great that Churchill will compare it to an iron curtain, a phrase that will go down in history. Churchill has been prime minister for 5 years, but unbeknownst to him, he will be voted out of office in just 3 months, rejected by the nation he loves, just as he was pushed aside by Stalin and FDR. For us, it remains only to say that in Franklin Roosevelt, there died the greatest American friend we have ever known and the greatest champion of freedom who has ever brought help and comfort from the new world to the old. Churchill concludes to a chorus of hear, hear from the MPs on both sides of the aisle. The exhausted prime minister has spoken for 20 minutes. He then takes his seat. Winston Churchill could use a scotch. This has been a very long day. Chapter 20, Third Army Headquarters, Hersfeld, Germany, April 17, 1945, morning. George Patton and Winston Churchill are simpatico. They both believe the Soviet Union is now the biggest threat to the world and to democracy. Patton is convinced that Churchill is the only man in power who knows what the world is walking into. For now, Patton keeps his comments to himself. Volatile words could get him fired or even killed. Patton is a man of strong beliefs, as he will tell the press in a few weeks. He is utterly sure of the Russian danger. Churchill had a sense of history. Unfortunately, some of our leaders were just damn fools who had no idea of Russian history. Hell, I doubt they even knew that Russia, just less than 100 years ago, owned Finland, sucked the blood out of Poland, and were using Siberia as a prison for their own people. How Stalin must have sneered when he got through with them at all these phony conferences, said Patton. This morning, the general sits at his desk in one of the small trailers that form his mobile command center, thinking about his future. Unless he finagles a command in the Pacific, he knows his career is all but done. Still a powerful force, the Third Army was poised to wheel north to capture Berlin, just as they made the hard left turn for Bastogne until Eisenhower stopped them. Patton believes that letting the Russians have Berlin is folly, and he told Eisenhower this a few days ago. Americans should not only take Berlin, Patton said, but keep on pushing as far to the east as possible. In time, the entire world will come to realize that Patton is right. But by then, it will be too late. The Russians have already pushed through Austria, now approaching Fortress Berlin from the south and east. Soon, they will take total control of Eastern Europe, a stranglehold they will maintain for the next 50 years. Fear of the Russians is spreading throughout Germany. Millions of civilian refugees flee towards the American lines, only to be turned back. More than a half million German soldiers have raised their hands in surrender, so they will not have to face the Russians. In fact, so many Wehrmacht fighters are giving up that the Allies no longer accept all prisoners of war because it is impossible to house and feed so many men. When the men of the once feared 11th Panzer Division attempt to quit the war, the Third Army will accept them as prisoners only under the condition they bring their own food. As Patton sips coffee in his headquarters, he knows that his future may lie as a civilian. He has once again appeared on the cover of Time magazine and is at last getting the kind of public respect and glory he desperately craves. Should Patton enter politics, he will be a formidable force. But the war is not over. For the first time in recent memory, the Third Army is not being ordered to go on the defensive. In fact, the opposite is true. Patton has just been given an additional 3 armored divisions so he can spearhead the final American attacks of the war in southern Germany. There was a big meeting yesterday, and we got the ball for what looks like the final play, he writes to Beatrice. As a general, he is not subject to having his letters read by military censors. Yet, his wording is deft. Nonetheless, he alludes to what is about to happen, yet does not violate national security, lest his letter somehow fall into German hands. The letter to his wife continues. Sometimes I feel that I may be nearing the end of this life. I have liberated J and licked the Germans, so what else is there to do? The J to whom Patton refers is his son-in-law, 38-year-old Colonel John Waters, who was captured in Tunisia 2 years ago. On the surface, Task Force Baum, the Hammelburg mission, was simply a daring attempt to rescue American prisoners of war. Shortly after crossing the Rhine in late March, Patton received word that the POW camp near the German town of Hammelburg held 300 U.S. soldiers, many of them officers. Its location was 60 long miles from Patton's army. Among the prisoners was Colonel John Waters, the husband of Patton's beloved daughter, Beatrice. After conquering the Polish town of Suzbin, Russian soldiers had discovered the remains of a hastily abandoned POW camp. The Allied prisoners had been marched 300 miles west in the dead of February to prevent their falling into Russian hands. Prison records showed that Waters was once incarcerated there. Patton will later insist that he did not know Waters was incarcerated in Hammelburg. Yet the truth is, he was informed of this fact by the American military mission in Moscow on February 9th. Furthermore, on the eve of the attack, Patton specifically wrote to Beatrice, "Hope to send an expedition tomorrow to get John." Patton's staff questioned his plan to rescue the prisoners, stating that Patton needed at least 3,500 men to liberate the POW camp, rather than the mere 300 who were being deployed. Even the hero of Bastogne, Lieutenant Colonel Abe Abrams, thought the mission so foolish that he turned it down, giving the command role to Lieutenant Harold Cohen. But Cohen didn't want it either. Patton called Cohen's bluff, ordering that he be taken into the next room and examined by a doctor. Only when the hemorrhoids were confirmed did Patton give the lead role to Captain Abraham J. Baum, the twice-wounded 23-year-old son of a Brooklyn blouse maker. Baum and his rescue force were already exhausted from the Rhine crossing. They were handed just 15 maps for 57 vehicles. It was possible that Task Force Baum would not even find Hammelburg, let alone the POW camp. Yet Patton, normally such a meticulous planner, ordered the rescue mission to proceed. General Douglas MacArthur had received a great deal of media exposure for liberating thousands of Allied POWs in the Pacific, and Patton hoped to make MacArthur look like a piker. German opposition was heavy, and soon half the task force lay dead or dying. But the Americans got through. Less than 24 hours after setting out, Task Force Baum miraculously arrived at the gates of O-Flag 13B, as the camp was known. Seeing gray uniforms, they began firing at what they mistakenly believed to be German guards. Instead, the uniforms belonged to Serbian prisoners of war being interned at the camp. The German commandant, General Gunther von Geckel, took pity on the Serbians and requested that a contingent of American prisoners march out the gates and tell their rescuers to cease firing. Meantime, von Geckel and the remaining German guards fled. They no longer had any interest in defending the POW camp. At 6:15 p.m., Patton's son-in-law, Colonel Waters, marched out the front gate carrying a white flag of surrender. Several American officers and a lone German officer were at his side. Waters was noticeably gaunt from more than 40 pounds of weight loss. He walked slowly, intending to tell Captain Baum to stop firing. Waters never made it. A German guard in a camouflage uniform, not knowing that a truce had been arranged by the camp commandant, steadied his rifle atop a fence post and took careful aim. The bullet entered John Waters' right hip and exited through his left buttocks. He collapsed to the ground, where he lay until he could be carried back to the camp. There, fellow POW and chief surgeon of the Yugoslavian army, Radovan Danik, quickly removed the bullet. As Task Force Baum stormed through the gates of the camp, cheered by hundreds of American prisoners, one thing became quite clear. Colonel John Waters wasn't physically capable of going anywhere. Captain Baum soon found himself faced with another dilemma. Instead of 300 POWs, there were well over 1,000. The task force simply did not have enough vehicles to carry every single prisoner back to freedom. The convoy needed to turn around and race back to the American lines under cover of darkness before the Germans could counterattack. An estimated 700 prisoners soon draped themselves atop tanks and half-tracks, gorging themselves on K-rations the task force had brought along for just that purpose. Those well enough to walk followed behind the column. The Germans did counterattack at sunrise the next morning. The strength of the Nazi reprisal was terrifying. Swiftly and efficiently, they destroyed the American column and began rounding up the POWs for their return to the camp. Many who were not prisoners of war before the rescue attempt now found themselves in German captivity. Wehrmacht soldiers used dogs to hunt down the Americans now scattered across the countryside. Captain Baum was burned when a rocket hit his tank and suffered a gunshot wound to the groin. Yet he managed to evade the Germans for almost 24 hours before being captured and led into captivity. 9 days later, the American 14th Armored Division liberated the POW camp. Patton's initial raid, which had cost 32 men their lives, was all for naught. George Patton immediately visited his son-in-law at a hospital in Frankfurt, where Colonel Waters had been taken to recuperate from his wounds. Upon seeing Patton, the colonel burst out, "Did you know I was at Hammelburg?" It was the first question out of Waters' mouth, because he well knew that many considered him to blame for the horrible waste of American lives. 32 Americans had been killed, almost 300 more wounded or taken prisoner. In addition, 16 tanks, 28 half-tracks, 12 jeeps, and a medical vehicle known as the Weasel were destroyed. "Not for sure," came the answer from his father-in-law. Patton has sworn a professional oath of honor that does not allow lying, cheating, or tolerating those who do so. Covering up the real reason for Task Force Baum was not the first of George Patton's untruths. One lie in particular broke his wife Beatrice's heart and almost cost him his marriage and may now be coming back to haunt him. For the beautiful young woman with whom he was secretly unfaithful has once again entered Patton's life. The year was 1935. The place, Hawaii. Jean Gordon was visiting the Patton family on her way to the Orient. A willowy, unmarried young woman who spoke fluent French. She was the daughter of Beatrice Patton's half-sister, and thus the general's niece by marriage. She also served as maid of honor at the wedding between Patton's daughter Beatrice and John Waters. Patton was old enough to know better. A career soldier and the father of three children, who had long enjoyed the love of a wife who understood his unusual temperament. Beatrice was a remarkable woman in her own right, capable of making conversation in German, French, Spanish, and Italian. She had written a book and had passion for music and drama. And a ferocious passion for her husband was such that on one occasion she physically attacked an officer who had disparaged her beloved Georgie. Patton had a prior off the man when she knocked him down and was banging his head on the tile floor. When the 18-year-old Jean began flirting with her husband, Beatrice was unaware. George Patton was flattered. So it was that when Beatrice Patton fell ill shortly before a planned journey from one Hawaiian island to another, Jean went in her place. There was no chaperone to prevent what occurred next. When a heartbroken Beatrice learned of the tryst, she told her daughter, Ruth Ellen, "It's lucky for us that I don't have a mother, because if I did, I'd pack up and go home to her right now." That might have been the end of it, because for all intents and purposes, the relationship between George Patton and Jean Gordon seemed to have run its course. But in the summer of 1944, Jean arrived in England as a Red Cross volunteer and wasted no time in reconnecting with Patton. When BHS learned that Jean was in England, she wrote to her husband that she was aware that Patton's former lover had returned to his side, but Patton denied spending time with the young woman. Still, once Third Army began its drive across France, Jean managed to get assigned to the task of Red Cross donut girl for the troops, visiting them and providing them with donuts, hot coffee, and conversation. She became a regular at Patton's headquarters, where she often spoke fluent French with the general. Infatuated, Patton confided to a West Point classmate, "She's been mine for 12 years." On March 31, 1945, Beatrice wrote to her husband, wondering why Jean Gordon was still in Europe. Patton replied, "I'm not a fool, so quit worrying." When, soon after, Patton learned that Jean Gordon was also having an affair with a young officer serving in a safe headquarters position, Patton, as competitive as ever, ordered the young man transferred to frontline combat. Late on the afternoon of April 17th, Patton flies to Paris. His son-in-law has been moved to a nearby hospital and sits with Waters for a long discussion. The controversy surrounding the Hamelburg incident seems to be blowing over. Dwight Eisenhower reprimanded Patton, but little else is being done. It appears there will be no further repercussions. Patton sits for breakfast the next morning with his old West Point classmate, General Everett Hughes. The two men are very close, and it is to Hughes that Patton confides his relationship with Jean Gordon. The waiter hands Hughes a copy of the American military newspaper Stars and Stripes. Hughes smiles at an announcement printed in the paper, but says nothing as he hands the newspaper over to Patton. Patton suddenly grins broadly as he reads the news that President Harry Truman has just nominated him for the rank of 4-star general. He leans back in his chair as those all around him in the dining room who've already read the news wait to see his response. Well, I'll be goddamn. The biblical David was also a great general. He was said to be a man after God's own heart, despite the fact that he slept with his best friend's wife, lied about the act, and then ordered the husband sent to the front line so he might be murdered in battle. Yet David ultimately paid a steep cost for his behavior, losing his son at a very young age and eventually losing his entire kingdom. Like David, George Patton knows himself to be a flawed yet God-fearing man. His recent bouts of duplicity have also cost more lives than the duplicity of King David. But as Patton flies back to his headquarters in a plane newly decorated with insignia denoting his 4-star rank, it appears that he will not endure the divine punishments that befell David. In fact, Patton has weathered the storm unscathed. But, as a devout general well knows, David once thought the same thing. This audio is dedicated to my father, William O'Reilly, who served his country as a naval officer in World War II, and to my grandfather, John O'Reilly, who served in World War I. Let's begin with General George Patton's own words. June 5, 1944. Quote, "We will win this war, but we'll win it only by fighting and showing the Germans that we've got more guts than they have or ever will have. We're not just going to shoot the sons of bitches. We're going to rip out their living goddamn guts and use them to grease the treads of our tanks." Prologue. Room 110, U.S. Army, 130th Station Hospital, Heidelberg, Germany, December 21st, 1945, 5 p.m. The man with 45 minutes to live cannot defend himself. General George S. Patton Jr. fears no one. But now he sleeps flat on his back in a hospital bed. His upper body is encased in plaster, the result of a car accident 12 days ago. Room 110 is a former utility closet, just 14 feet by 16 feet. There are no decorations, pictures on the walls, or elaborate furnishings, just the narrow bed, white walls, and a single high window. A chair has been brought in for Patton's wife, Beatrice, who endured a long white-knuckle flight over the North Atlantic from the family home in Boston to be at his bedside. She sits there now, crochet hook, moving silently back and forth, raising her eyes every few moments to see if her husband has awakened. General Patton is fond of the finer things in life, and during the course of the Second World War, he made his battlefield headquarters in mansions, palaces, castles, and 5-star hotels. But right now, the sole concession to luxury is that, as a 4-star general, Patton does not have to share his room with another patient. Old Blood and Guts, as his soldiers refer to the 60-year-old legend, is a man both revered and feared. He has many enemies. Thus, the need for the white-helmeted armed guards posted directly outside his door, at the end of the long hallway leading to the hospital lobby, and at every entrance and exit of the hospital building. Nicknamed for their helmets, these snowdrops protect Patton from the American journalists who have descended on this quiet former cavalry barracks in a great pack, ignoring the ongoing Nuremberg war trials so that they might write about Patton's accident and expected recovery. General Patton is getting well like a house afire, the Associated Press reported 4 days ago, basing its information on the Army's daily 6 p.m. briefing about Patton's condition. The story also reported that the general sat up in bed, throwing off his injury with, quote, a speed reminiscent of his wartime advances, unquote. The truth, however, is far different. General George Patton is paralyzed from the neck down. Bones in his spine were dislocated when his car collided with an Army truck full of drunken, joyriding soldiers. Patton's number 3 cervical vertebra was shattered, badly bruising his spinal cord. The good news is that he has recovered some movement in his extremities. The bad news is his doctors believe it is highly unlikely he will ever walk again. The reporters don't know this, and so they work overtime to invade Patton's privacy to see his amazing recovery for themselves. Some have tried to sneak into room 110, dressed as nurses or orderlies. Others have bribed hospital staff with Hershey bars and nylons. Thanks to the centuries, however, all of them have failed. The closest call was when Richard H. O'Regan, the same reporter from the Associated Press who wrote of Patton's remarkable recovery, caged an interview with Patton's nurse by pretending to be a patient. For his trouble, O'Regan was able to reveal to the world that doctors were allowing Patton to sip a thimbleful of whiskey each night with dinner. But reporters are the least of General Patton's worries. Throughout the course of the Second World War, he made many high-ranking enemies in Moscow, Berlin, London, and even Washington, D.C. Patton's fiery determination to speak the truth had many powerful men squirming, not only during the war, but also afterward. He recently went on the record praising his former German enemies for their skills as soldiers, while also criticizing the Soviet Union as being a foe rather than an ally of the USA. Some have come to see Patton as a roadblock to world peace, and now Patton is at his most vulnerable, an easy target for any of those enemies. A year to this day, General Patton was in the midst of the most glorious battle of his career, racing across France with his beloved Third Army to rescue American forces pinned down at the crossroads in Bastogne, Belgium. The German army had long considered Patton to be the Allies' greatest general, but the Battle of the Bulge, as it would become known, elevated him to legendary status throughout the world. Now, the swaggering, fearless renegade who prowled the front lines in a specially modified Dodge WC-57 command car, outfitted with a 50-caliber machine gun, siren, and 2 air horns to announce his arrival, is hidden from the public. The George S. Patton, who sleeps fitfully as Friday evening descends upon Heidelberg, has a low pulse and a high fever. He drank eggnog for lunch and for a time felt upbeat, but his energy sagged before he finally fell asleep. A blood clot in his lungs made his face turn blue yesterday, and there are fears that another embolism might soon give him more trouble breathing. The auto accident was brutal. Stitches and bruising cover Patton's head from the bridge of his nose to the top of his scalp, marking the line where doctors sewed a Y-shaped flap of his skin back onto his head. His face is gaunt from weight loss, and there are open holes in his cheekbones where doctors drilled into his face to insert steel fishhooks to hold his head in traction. But the general has a high pain threshold and has endured his sufferings with a smile and his usual blue humor. He banters with the nurses who find him cute. Despite the fact that he has taken a sudden and unexpected turn for the worse in the past few days, the general still expects to be flown to Beverly General Hospital in Boston to further his recovery. Beatrice has been with him around the clock, reading to him and calling for the doctors when he has a hard time catching his breath. She has a small room of her own down the hall, but is rarely there. The former heiress is a plain woman with a charismatic personality wed Patton just a year after he graduated from West Point. Throughout their 35 years of marriage, Beatrice has braved the many hardships of military life for her beloved Georgie, never wavering in her love and support. Suddenly, Patton wakes up. His dark blue eyes flick back and forth, searching for signs of Beatrice. There she is. "Are you all right, Georgie?" Beatrice asks. She is every bit as fiery as her husband, a fearless equestrian and accomplished sailor. Patton gazes intensely at his wife. She is the only woman he ever truly loved and the mother of his three children. Beatrice leans forward to pat her husband's hand. "It's so dark," Patton says, "so late." He closes his eyes and falls back to sleep. Beatrice soon leaves for the hospital mess, where she hopes to grab a quick dinner before returning to the bedside, not knowing that her husband has just spoken his last words. At 6 p.m., the urgent news is delivered for Beatrice to return immediately to room 110, but she is too late. The general whom Nazi Germany feared more than any other, the former Olympic pentathlete, the cavalry officer who once hunted the infamous Pancho Villa across the desert plains of Mexico, and the warrior who publicly stated that he wanted one day to be killed by, quote, "the last bullet in the last battle of the last war," is already dead. The official military report states that General Patton died at 1745, 21 December 1945. A pulmonary embolism brought on by his 12 days lying immobile had weakened his heart. The official causes of death, as listed in the Army Adjutant General's report, are, quote, "traumatic myelitis, transverse fourth cervical segment, pulmonary infarction, and myocardial failure, acute," unquote. There is no autopsy. His body is immediately taken to the hospital basement and placed inside what was once a horse stall, where his personal four-star flag is laid over the corpse. At Beatrice's request, Patton is laid to rest at the American Cemetery in Ham, Luxembourg, near the scene of his greatest battlefield triumph. Years later, when Beatrice falls from a horse and dies, she will be denied burial next to her husband, so her children will secretly smuggle her ashes into Europe and sprinkle them atop the grave. It is a grave that may hold deep secrets. The truth is, some do not believe Patton's death was accidental. He had already survived several accidents, including the time his personal airplane was almost shot down by a British Spitfire fighter plane in April 1945. Almost miraculously, Patton escaped injury. But the auto crash that paralyzed Patton on December 9, 1945, was a far different story. The 2.5-ton GMC Army truck that collided with the general's touring car suddenly and inexplicably veered from the opposite lane into Patton, as if intentionally trying to injure the general. Both the man driving the truck and his two passengers quickly vanished after the incident. No criminal charges were ever filed. No accountability was ever recorded. Also, both the official accident report and several key witnesses soon went missing. And most ominous of all, a former American intelligence operative confessed in October 1979 that he had planned and participated in the assassination of General George S. Patton, Jr. It was a shocking assertion that was mostly ignored. And so it was that a man who saw so much death on the battlefields of Europe and Africa officially died in a most pedestrian way. Officially. Chapter 1, The Hills Above Metz, France, October 3, 1944, 12:02 p.m. Private First Class Robert W. Holmlund is scared. He believes his life may be over at age 21. The American assault is just 2 minutes old, 2 minutes that feel like 20. The private serves as an explosives expert in the 3rd Army, Company B, 11th Infantry Regiment, 5th Infantry Division. Holmlund is a student from the American heartland who left trade school to join a war. His senior commander is the most ferocious general on the Allied side, George Patton, Jr. But unlike Patton, who now oversees his vast army from the safety of his headquarters 25 miles behind the front, Holmlund and his men, a Baker company, are in grave danger as they sprint toward the heavily defended German fort known as Drianque. German machine gun bullets whiz past Holman's helmet at twice the speed of sound. Heads and torsos shatter all around him. U.S. artillery thunders in the distance behind them, laying down cover fire. The forest air smells of gunpowder, rain, and the sharp tang of cordite. The ground is nothing but mud and a thick carpet of wet leaves. Here and there, a bramble vine reaches out to snag his uniform and trip his feet. Over his broad shoulders, Holmlund wears a block of TNT known as a satchel charge. Grenades dangle from his cartridge belt like grapes on a vine. And in his arms, rather than carrying it by the wooden handle atop the stock, Holmlund cradles his 15-pound, 4-foot-long Browning automatic rifle, or BAR. He carries it as he would an infant. Only this baby is a killing machine, capable of firing 653-inch bullets per minute. Though he doesn't show it, Robert Holmlund is scared. Despite all that firepower, just like every single man in this lethal forest. But there's no time to indulge his fear right now. No time for homesickness or doubt. Fort Trient looms 400 yards distant. Everything about the fortress is a mystery, from the location of its big 150mm howitzers to the maze of tunnels deep underground where its Wehrmacht inhabitants eat, sleep, pray, clean their rifles, plan their battles, and then suddenly poke their heads out of secret openings to kill Americans. Patton has ordered Baker Company to get inside Trient. The best way to do that is to climb on the roof, which is concealed by mounds of earth. From there, it's a matter of finding a doorway or some other hidden opening that will allow Baker to descend and wage war in the tunnels. Baker is part of a two-pronged assault. On the opposite side of the fort, the men of Easy Company are also on the attack, but they do so warily, for Trient has already bloodied them once. It happened 6 days ago. Skies were clear. P-47 fighter bombers screamed in low on the morning of the assault, dropping napalm and 1,000-pound bombs. American artillery then pounded Trient, shelling the Germans with deadly accuracy. Easy Company launched their attack alongside the men of George Company at 14:15 hours under a heavy smoke screen. They had no way of knowing that the aerial bombardment and ground artillery had virtually no effect on the Wehrmacht fighters, nor that the enemy was snug and secure within Trient's 15-foot-thick walls and in hidden forest pillboxes. Step by step, thinking themselves unseen, the American soldiers advanced, fingers on triggers as the men scanned the forest, waiting for the muzzle flashes that would expose the enemy. But the Germans did not shoot. Not yet. So Easy and George crept closer to Trient. With each passing moment, they became more convinced that the smokescreen had completely concealed them. They marched closer and closer, and still no German gunshots. Soon, a thick tangle of barbed wire loomed before the Americans, marking the outer perimeter of Trient's defenses. There was no way through the razor-sharp coils. The advance ground to a halt. Then, the Germans opened fire. The autumn afternoon was rent by a terrifying sound the Americans knew all too well. Their slang for the high-speed ripping sound of a German MG-42 machine gun is Hitler's zipper. To the Wehrmacht, this killing tone is simply the bone saw. MG-42s opened up from every direction. Bullets tore through the woods at 1,200 rounds per minute, capable of killing a man from more than a half mile away. But the machine guns were just the beginning. Soon mortars, rifles, and even heavy artillery pounded the Americans from every direction. And just like that, the American attack was over. Soldiers hugged the ground for 4 long hours as German gunners pinpointed their positions and took slow, deliberate aim. It was only after darkness fell that the men of Company E and Company G crawled back to the safety of the American lines. September 27th was a very bad day for the men of Easy. By the end of the fight, 18 soldiers had been either killed or wounded. Today will be even worse. Private Holmlund can go no further, nor can the rest of Baker Company. The mountain of barbed wire surrounding Trient blocks their path. 30 feet tall and just as thick, the impenetrable tangle waits to trap any man unlucky enough to snag his uniform or his body within its tendrils. Clipping at it with hand cutters will take days, which is why Holmlund's company commander, Captain Harry Anderson, has given the order, blow the wire to hell. Behind him, Holmlund hears the low rumble of a Continental R-975 air-cooled engine. The telltale crunch of steel treads soon follows, announcing the arrival of an M4 Sherman tank. Even as the German machine gunners continue to fire on Baker, the Sherman weaves through the trees and takes aim. Its 75-millimeter gun belches smoke as it fires a round of M48 high explosive into the wire. A direct hit is soon followed by another, and then another. Within moments, the barbed wire parts just enough for Baker Company to sprint through. Captain Anderson splits the soldiers into three groups. Homeland's squad continues toward Driant in a straight line, while the other two squads flank to the right. The landscape is pocked with shell craters, like a man-made lunar surface. Trees and shrubs grow randomly, offering just the slightest bit of camouflage from the German defenders. The private is in the first wave of American attackers. He dives into a shell crater, presses himself flat against the lip, then pokes his head over the top and fires his bar at the enemy. Homeland then sprints forward to a row of small elm trees, where he once again takes cover and seeks out a target. The ground is cool and damp, moisture seeping through his uniform. He fires and moves forward, always forward, never taking his focus off the flat roof of Driant. Despite the cool October temperature, Homeland is now drenched in sweat. His face and hands are flecked with mud. He hurls himself into another shell crater and hugs the earth. This close to the ground, he is eye level with the fungus and bright green mold sprouting up through the fallen leaves. Bullets whiz low over his head. He reloads and listens, waiting for the chance to fire. The sounds of the battlefield are familiar. The chatter of machine guns, the screams of the mortally wounded, the concussive thud of hand grenades, orders barked in short, terse sentences, screams for medic fill the air. Homeland fires a burst from his rifle and then runs forward. He races past fallen comrades. He knows them all. They did push-ups side by side during basic training in Alabama. They sailed together for Europe in the hold of a troop ship. They sat in an English pasture just hours before D-Day, listening to General Patton deliver the greatest speech any of them had ever heard. And then after D-Day, Homeland and Baker fought their way across France, rejoicing as they captured one small village after another, following Patton's order that they kill Germans in brutal and relentless fashion, lest they themselves be killed first. Now many of Holdrum's buddies lie dead or dying, and so ends the sound of their laughter, their rage, their boasts, their tales about that special girl back home, and all that talk about what they're going to do with their lives once the war ends. Homeland doesn't even give them a second glance, and he doesn't stop moving forward. To stop is to become a target. Homeland's fighting squad dwindles from 12 men down to 6. His squad leader is hit. Homeland takes command without thinking twice about it. Slowly, in the form of progress that is measured in feet and inches instead of yards, Baker Company moves closer and closer to the German fortress. 2 hours into the battle, PFC Robert Homeland of Delavan City, Wisconsin, finds himself standing atop Fort Driant. The real hero, Holmgren heard George S. Patton say just 4 months ago, is the man who fights even though he's scared. Some men get over their fright in a minute under fire. For some, it takes days. But a real man will never let his fear of death overwhelm his honor, his sense of duty to his country, and his innate manhood. As Holmgren watched, General Patton drew himself up to his full 6'2" height. His shoulders were broad and his face ruddy, with a strong chin and an aquiline nose. His uniform was a marvel, with 4 rows of ribbons, 4 shiny brass buttons, a polished helmet bearing his 3 general stars, tan riding pants, and knee-high cavalry boots. Most vividly, a Colt 45 caliber pistol with an ivory grip was holstered on his hip, sending a strong signal that Patton is no bureaucrat. He's a warrior, and everybody had better know it. Patton continued his speech. Battle is the most magnificent competition in which a human being can indulge. It brings out all that is best, and it removes all that is base. Americans pride themselves on being he-men, and they are he-men. Remember that the enemy is just as frightened as you are, and that they are not supermen. George Patton delivered the speech in the British countryside to the men of his Third Army on June 5, 1944. Some of the soldiers watching were combat veterans. Most, like Homeland, were brand new to the theater. They found hope in Patton's words. They found a belief in their own courage. And most of all, each man sitting in that pasture under a glorious blue English sky found strength in the knowledge that he was being commanded by the most audacious, forthright, and brilliant general on either side of the war. Until that day, Homeland had never seen Patton in the flesh and had only heard stories about the legendary general, the man who'd never lost a battle, hero of North Africa and Sicily, but who was temporarily relieved of his command for slapping two privates convalescing in a military hospital whom he considered cowardly. Neither Homeland nor any of the thousands of other soldiers seated in this pasture had any idea that their feelings for the general would come to vacillate between love and hate. In fact, Patton's nickname is Old Blood and Guts, with the understanding that the guts of Patton rode on the blood of his soldiers. "You are not all going to die," Patton reassured the men, whom he would soon lead into combat. His voice was high instead of gruff, which came as a surprise to Homeland. "Only 2% of you right here today will die in a major battle. Death must not be feared. Death, in time, comes to all men." 1/2 mile north of where Private Homeland and the men of Company B are making their stand atop Fort Driant, death, as predicted, is coming to his fellow soldiers in easy company. The hope of Patton's speech now long forgotten. Unlike their first attack on Driant 6 days ago, Company E made it through the barbed wire this time. But the Germans turned that into a fatal accomplishment, for once inside, Easy was pinned down with precision mortar fire. Going forward has become impossible. Even worse, enemy shells are exploding to their rear, meaning that retreating back through the wire is also out of the question. Easy Company tries to solve the problem by calling in an artillery strike on their own position. But this danger-close barrage does nothing to stop the dug-in German gunners. Instead, friendly fire kills one of their own in a most gruesome fashion. The soldier's head is sliced cleanly from his body by a piece of flying explosive. Easy Company digs in. They have no choice. 2-foot-long portable shovels scrape troughs in the earth as German machine gunners continue to rake Easy's position. It is every man for himself. The terror continues. The Germans take aim with 8 cm Granitfire 34 mortar fire and MG-42 machine guns. The Americans are defenseless. Killing them is as easy as finding the target and patiently squeezing the trigger. The Germans are in no hurry. The Americans are going nowhere. One after another, the young men who comprise Easy Company are cut down in their prime. The company medics race from foxhole to tend to the wounded. But soon, one after another, they too die. Hours pass. Rain drizzles down. The nightmare chatter of machine guns accompanies the sounds of Company E, digging their trenches deeper and deeper. Each man squats as low as possible, careful not to lift his head above ground level. Doing so would be an act of suicide. Easy's foxholes become filled with water, mud, blood, and each man's personal filth. Trench foot, from prolonged exposure to cold and wet, has become so common since the autumn rains arrived that it makes standing in yet another puddle a time of agony. But the men are beyond caring about the stench and squalor of their fighting holes. All they want to do is stay alive. "Americans despise cowards," Patton continued all those months ago, putting his own spin on U.S. history. "Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost, nor ever will lose a war. For the very idea of losing is hateful to an American. All through your Army careers, you men have bitched about what you call chicken shit drilling. That, like everything else in this Army, has a definite purpose. That purpose is alertness. Alertness must be bred into every soldier. I don't give an F for a man who's not always on his toes. You men are veterans, or you wouldn't be here. You are ready for what's to come. A man must be alert at all times if he expects to stay alive. If you're not alert, sometime a German son of a bitch is going to sneak up behind you and beat you to death with a sock full of crap." A handful of senior officers listening to the speech disapproved of Patton's coarse language. Patton could not care less. He believes that profanity is the language of the soldier, and that to speak to a soldier, one must use words that will have the most impact. Few can deny that George Patton is entitled to this belief, nor that he is the consummate soldier. He is descended from a Civil War Confederate colonel, and he himself has been in the military since graduating from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in 1909. Soon after, he fought in Mexico against Pancho Villa. He then fought in the First World War at San Miguel, the legendary battlefield west of Metz, where he now walks. Patton was the very first officer ever assigned to the U.S. Army Tank Corps and is renowned for his tactical brilliance on the battlefield. He lives by the words of the great French General Napoleon. Audacity, audacity, always audacity. A motto that works well on the field of battle, but not so well in diplomatic situations. Patton has damaged his career again and again by saying and doing the sort of impulsive things that would see a lesser man relieved of his command for good. An army is a team, Patton continues. It lives, sleeps, eats, and fights as a team. This individual heroic stuff is pure horseshit. The bilious bastards who write that kind of stuff for the Saturday Evening Post don't know anything more about fighting under fire than they know about effing. Patton was forced to pause, as he knew he would be. The waves of laughter rolling toward the stage were deafening. 4 months later, Patton knows the battle for Metz is failing and that Easy Company is being decimated. Even more galling, his intelligence briefing about the defenders of Fort Drouin was wrong. These are not the cook's clerks and new recruits that he was led to expect. These are hardened German veterans willing to die for their Nazi Führer, Adolf Hitler. They are not about to surrender. Word is arriving from the battlefield that the attack is stalled. For the second time in 6 days, an assault on Drouin teeters on the brink of failure. Normally in such a situation, Patton might jump into his staff car and race to the battlefield to direct the action. More than one soldier has been shocked to see the general himself barking orders at the front lines. But that is clearly impossible now. The risk would be far too great. So Patton can only pace in his headquarters, fret, swear loudly, and quietly seethe about the lack of gasoline and bullets that are limiting his ability to assault Drouin with a massive full-blown attack. Due to a shortage of supplies, Patton has been capable of sending only two companies, numbering just 300 men, to capture this citadel. It is madness. He should have far more firepower at his disposal. George Patton wants to defeat the Germans at Drouin for any number of reasons, but the deep desire to wage war is at the top of the list. Decisions above his pay grade and logistical difficulties have forced the Third Army to a screeching halt after 6 weeks of nonstop running battle. He had hoped that his rush from one side of France to the other would continue all the way across Germany to Berlin, where he planned on winning the war single-handedly. "We shall attack and attack until we are exhausted, and then we'll attack again," he boldly ordered his troops. And they did. Patton's aggressive tactics have placed the Third Army far in advance of the British forces who are approaching Germany to the north. But now the supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe, General Dwight Eisenhower, has ordered Patton to go on the defensive while allocating precious supplies of gasoline and bullets to the armies of British Field Marshal Bernard Law Montgomery. It is Monty, a finicky and self-important Englishman who considers himself a far superior general to Patton, who has been given the go-ahead to launch a decisive offensive toward Germany's Rhine River. For the time being, there will be no more forward movement by the Third Army. Patton feels that decision was Ike's call, based on his incorrect assessment of the battlefield. Allied politics also played a role. The British have suffered grievously for 5 years, with London being devastated by German bombing. Tens of thousands of British subjects have died in the streets. Winston Churchill and his government want to deliver their vengeance. The Nazi dictator Hitler was on the verge of victory and might even have forced Great Britain to its knees had it not invaded Russia. By opening a two-front war, Hitler put too much pressure on his ferocious military machine. The 10-million-man Wehrmacht could not possibly control all the hundreds of thousands of square miles it conquered, and so began the inevitable Nazi retreat, which is now in its final stages. But the Germans are fiercely defending their homeland as Allied forces push toward the Rhine River border. The fighting is hard and personal, and Patton wants a piece of it. Nevertheless, Eisenhower has reduced Patton's fuel and supply lines to a trickle. But rather than simply sit still, per Eisenhower's directive, Patton has chosen to adjust his lines by crossing the Moselle River and conquering the ancient city of Metz. One problem. In order to take the city, he must first conquer Fort Driant, with its big guns capable of lobbing artillery shells into the town square. Only then will Patton accept Eisenhower's order that the Third Army stand down. Right now, that moment of victory seems far away. In fact, what Patton desperately needs is one of his soldiers to do something audacious that will turn the tide in this desperate battle. That man, unbeknownst to anyone, is PFC Robert Holmlin. The Germans are now doing the unthinkable. They're calling in friendly fire on their own positions. Private Holmlin presses his body flat against the ground as shell after artillery shell explodes on the roof of Fort Driant. The concussion of each blast feels like a sharp kick in the stomach. A wave of nausea washes over him, and his eardrums feel as if they are about to burst. No longer are the Germans content to wage a defensive gun battle with Company B. Instead, they have radioed to nearby German gun batteries and requested that they fire artillery onto the top of the fort to dislodge the Americans. Exposed and vulnerable, the men of Baker can do nothing to fight back. From his vantage point on the roof, Private Holmlin sees an odd sight among the tangle of shrubs and dead grass atop the fort. It appears to be some sort of conical grate. Holmlin kicks at it. The grate flies to one side, revealing a narrow pipe leading straight down into the fort. It has never occurred to Holmlin or any of the other men from Baker Company that such a pipe would exist. But it's logical, because the Germans hunkered down inside Fort Driant need some form of ventilation. The conical shape lets in air but keeps out rain. Holmlin considers dropping his satchel charge down into the pipe, but it would never fit. The canvas cover holding the charge is too bulky and likely to get stuck before falling more than a few inches in. Instead, he calls out for a Bangalore torpedo, 5 feet long, 2 inches wide, and packed with 9 pounds of dynamite. The slender tube of explosive is the perfect solution. A soldier in Holmlin's squad hands one over. Holmlin sets his bar on the top rooftop, then pulls a blasting cap out of one cartridge pocket. He inserts the primary explosive device into the recessed tail end of the Bangalore. When the blasting cap explodes, it will force a much larger secondary explosion from the TNT within the torpedo. Holmlin lights the time-delayed fuse, measured to ensure that the Bangalore will fall the length of the ventilation shaft before exploding. Then he drops the torpedo down and rolls away from the shaft. The Bangalore clatters against the side of the metal pipe as it falls. There's a quiet moment just before it hits the bottom. Then comes the explosion. The thunder is enormous, rocketing back up the ventilation shaft. Holmlin soon hears confused Germans screaming at one another. He preps another Bangalore and drops it inside. The second explosion elicits even more chaos among the Germans. They're trampling over one another, trying to get out, Holmlin says to a member of his fighting squad. The building turns out to be a barracks. Holmlin calmly leads the rest of the men off the roof and down to a locked fort entrance. It takes time, several rounds of well-placed explosives, and a direct shot from a nearby self-propelled howitzer, but the massive steel door finally gives way. Thanks to the quick thinking of Robert Holmlin, Company B soon enters Fort Driant. The tide of the battle has shifted. Captain Harry Anderson leads the charge into the subterranean world. Now winning the battle is a bloody but simple matter of going from tunnel to tunnel to flush out the defenders, or so Captain Anderson believes. Baker is joined in the tunnels by Company G, a group of reinforcements led by Captain Jack Jerry, a man whose bravery under fire is well known within the 11th Infantry Regiment. The Germans and Americans soon fight in close quarters, the deafening clamor of explosives and gunshots thundering down the narrow corridors. Death comes from all angles, as bullets ricochet off the thick concrete walls. Companies B and G make their way deeper and deeper into the fort, but the Wehrmacht soldiers thwart their advance by filling the tunnels from floor to ceiling with debris as they retreat. Clearing a path is both time-consuming and dangerous for the Americans, but they take fire the minute they blast a hole in the blockades. With night about to fall, an exhausted PFC Robert Holmlin and his squad leave the tunnels. They are needed on the roof, where they will set up a defensive position to guard against a German counterattack. The plan is for Holmlin and his men to return to the tunnels tomorrow to continue the slow and deliberate underground battle. Once on the roof, Homeland hears the telltale radial engine drone of American P-47 Thunderbolt fighter-bomber aircraft. After a full day without air power, the skies have cleared up enough to get the planes airborne. But the timing is odd. With American forces out in the open, it's not the right time to drop bombs. That's when Homeland notices that the planes aren't flying toward Baker's position. They're headed for the opposite side of the fort and a very exposed Easy Company. The German fighting force that has toyed with Easy Company all afternoon is now counterattacking, leaving their dug-in positions to confront the Americans directly. The aim of the Wehrmacht is to kill the Americans in their fighting holes. The Americans are exhausted. The corpses of their dead reek of decomposition. An infection is setting in among the wounded. But the P-47 pilots save the day, strafing the Wehrmacht positions with their eight-wing-mounted 50-caliber machine guns and dropping 500-pound bombs down on top of the advancing German force. Within moments, the Germans fall back to the underground tunnels. But the Germans don't go away. Soon enough, they return to harassing Easy Company from the distant safety of bunkers and the fort, firing on them with mortars and machine guns. Night falls, and when the Thunderbolt pilots can no longer see their targets, they fly the 100 miles back to the safety of their base in Saint-Dizier and the warmth of a hot shower and a clean bed before taking to the skies the next morning, leaving the men of Easy Company to do their best to survive in their foxholes overnight. Thanks to the possibility of yet another German counterattack, sleep is not an option. Private Homeland is exhausted. The German counterattack came just as expected. Homeland once again displayed the sort of selfless courage that George Patton spoke about in England. As the German forces swept across the roof of Drianet, trying to push back Company B and Company G, Homeland ignored the hail of bullets. Knowing that his Browning automatic rifle had the sort of rapid fire that could effectively halt the German attack, he raced from a safe defensive position to a new fighting spot, one that was completely exposed to enemy fire. After only a short time in the army, Homeland had developed a strategic intuition similar to that of the great Patton. In an act of courage that Patton will one day personally reward with a Distinguished Service Cross, Private Homeland pours fire directly at the Germans. All by himself, Homeland scatters an entire German unit and ends their counterattack. The retreat accomplished, Homeland finds a quiet corner on the roof. But before he can rest, he double-checks that each man in his squad has chosen a solid defensive position. A second counterattack is likely, and he wants Baker to be ready. There are just four men left in his squad. Eight have been killed or wounded. Homeland crouches low as he studies his men's locations and inquires about ammo and water to last the night. It's not a selfless act. Great leaders take care of their men first and then worry about their own needs. Suddenly, a shot rings out. A German sniper's rifle has spoken. PFC Robert Homeland from Wisconsin drops to the ground, dead. Things are going very badly at Fort Drianet, George Patton writes in his journal. It is nighttime in his headquarters. The Third Army lost 110 men in the first day of fighting, and the toll continues to rise. Patton has spent the evening pacing, fretting, and resisting the urge to smoke a cigar, a habit he is forever trying to quit. We may have to abandon the attack because it's not worth the cost. I was over-optimistic. Days have passed since Robert Homeland dropped that Bangalore down into the German barracks. The battle for Drianet has become a bloody stalemate. It is quiet far behind the lines at Patton Chateau in the small town of Etienne. But he can envision the chaos at Drianet. Reports from the battlefield have been grim, with casualties mounting and no forward progress being made. Easy can go nowhere. The men are dazed and drained by more than 3 days without sleep, food, or water. The Germans are so well hidden and have zeroed in on the American position so accurately that any attempt to reinforce or rescue Easy is tantamount to suicide. The number of dead in the unit is more than 30 and rising by the hour. But enemy fire is so intense that no bodies can be removed. In the words of one fellow general, Patton paces like a caged tiger. He is in no mood to lose a battle, particularly when Montgomery and the British have been given the green light and the gasoline to attack deep into Germany. Pat knows his reputation could be damaged by any defeat. He is also aware that the nature of warfare is that many men will lose their lives.